From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. A ceasefire in the Middle East appears to be holding even after Israeli security forces shot rubber bullets at Palestinians outside the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem today. Israeli officials said they were responding to a riot with Palestinians throwing stones at police. Today's unrest follows 11 days of fighting that left more than 250 people dead, most of them in the Gaza Strip.
President Biden has welcomed the ceasefire, and Secretary of State Antony Blinken is scheduled to visit the region in the coming days. Meanwhile, the administration is engaged in a different kind of diplomacy in Washington today, inviting Republican senators to the White House to talk infrastructure. We've got our Friday roundtable here to break it all down for us. Kimberly Atkins is a columnist for the Boston Globe. Hi, Kim.
Hi there.
And Scott Wong is also with us. He's senior staff writer for The Hill. Hi, Scott.
Hi, guys.
So let's start with the Middle East. President Biden praised the truce between Israel and Palestinian militants in a brief address from the White House yesterday. Here he is.
And I send my sincere condolences to all the families, Israeli and Palestinian, who have lost loved ones, and my hope for a full recovery for the wounded.
The U.S. initially backed what it called Israel's right to self-defense, but as the fighting went on, the White House increasingly pressured Israel to stop its military campaign. Biden had multiple calls with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Kimberly, this was one of Biden's first extended foreign policy crises as president. How do you think he's handled it?
Well, I think we've seen him handle it just about as much as you would expect. Joe Biden has been very has had a laser focus on domestic policy, really focused on, as we talked about, the infrastructure plan and other things. And he certainly did not want external forces to upend that. But also we have seen this crisis in the Middle East just change a lot as well. And he certainly had to address it both because of the to effectuate a ceasefire, but also to assuage some of the Democrats within his own.
Did we just lose Kim?
I think we lost her.
All right. Well, Scott, why don't we move on to you? Do you think that this moment is an opening for the White House to start more overt diplomacy to bring longer term peace to the region?
Well, I think it's still too early to say. I mean, as you pointed out, this is still a very fragile ceasefire. And while it held through the night and into today, violence could erupt at any moment again. And we've already seen some of those skirmishes that you mentioned in Jerusalem today. So I don't think anyone's taking a victory lap here after the ceasefire was announced. I do expect, and we heard from President Biden yesterday, that his administration is going to continue to stay engaged. Congressional leaders are watching this closely. And I think if the peace holds, we're going to see Washington turn more of its focus to the humanitarian and reconstruction side of this in the coming months, because of, you know, buildings have been toppled, electrical and water systems have been taken out. Families have been displaced and many people are still injured. So, you know, Biden has pledged that he wants to work with the Palestinian Authority, not with Hamas, of course, which the U.S. has labeled a terrorist organization, but with the Palestinian Authority on the reconstruction efforts. And I think that's where the focus will be in these coming months if this ceasefire holds.
Well, there's also the lingering political questions at home that Kimberly had hinted at. We saw this week Democratic Representative Rashida Tlaib confront the president on the airport tarmac in Michigan. Senator Bernie Sanders and Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez have introduced resolutions to block U.S. weapon sales to Israel that had already been approved. Kimberly, I think we have you back. Do you think that this issue is going to keep percolating here domestically in Congress?
I think it absolutely will. A lot has changed since Joe Biden left the White House in the Obama administration to what is happening now. I remember the last time I was in Israel back in 2016 and talking to Palestinians. They were expressing a real kinship to the Black Lives Matter movement that was happening in America and that increase in activism. And we're seeing that very same thing happen among Democrats in Congress right now, really wanting the Biden administration to address what they see as the human rights abuses happening in Israel. When you look at things like how lopsided the casualties were in the recent fighting and the efforts to destroy Palestinian homes. So I think we're seeing much more effort. I mean, that 8-minute discussion that Congresswoman Tlaib had with Joe Biden on the tarmac in Detroit this week was seen as one of those turning points where Biden really having the ear of these Democrats that are really pushing for a more aggressive tone against Israel on that front.
I want to move on to a few things that are moving or not moving, as the case may be, through Congress this week. Republican senators meet with White House officials today to talk infrastructure. They still want a much smaller bill than the $2 trillion that Biden has proposed. Kimberly, these talks have been going on for weeks now. Are they making any progress?
It's unclear whether it is, but that's not for a lack of trying on the part of the White House. Lately, the Biden administration is reaching out to local officials, Republican mayors and governors who really want to see this infrastructure package move forward in an effort to try to convince Republicans to get on board as well. Whether that will be enough, it's really unclear. So far, Republicans have been really unified in their opposition to the breadth of this infrastructure plan, really wanting to focus on roads and bridges and traditional projects and not want to give not giving very much at all on the broader proposal that the president is pushing.
Well, Scott, speaking of Republican opposition, we saw the House this week call for an independent commission to investigate the Capitol insurrection on January 6th. There were 35 Republicans who did join Democrats in supporting that. What's the situation look like now in the Senate, especially now that this week Mitch McConnell came out and said, no, he's not for it?
Yeah, I think we can read that as things don't look great for that January 6th commission bill in the Senate. One gauge of that is looking at how the seven Republican senators who voted to convict Donald Trump. There are a handful, Susan Collins, Mitt Romney, Bill Cassidy, who all have said they're open to supporting that commission. But others in that group of seven, like Richard Burr, is opposed. Ben Sasse is leaning no on the commission. And so, that's significant because Chuck Schumer needs 10 Republicans to come across the aisle to buck their leadership and vote for that commission in order to overcome a Republican filibuster. And right now, it's hard to see that where those 10 votes come from, given not only, opposition from Mitch McConnell, who called the legislation slanted and unbalanced and that commission slanted and unbalanced, but also the opposition coming from Donald Trump, who really still remains, has a firm grasp and a firm hold on the Republican Party. And a lot of Republicans are still fearful to go against the former president.
Well, there's also a bipartisan deal on gun background checks that looks unlikely in the Senate, and a police reform bill that lawmakers had wanted to enact by May 25th, which, of course, is the anniversary of George Floyd's death. Kimberly, are Democrats likely to get any support from Republicans on those issues, and what are the sticking points there?
Yeah, I mean, I think given the events of this week, I would see that as very unlikely. When it comes to the policing bill, the sticking point is qualified immunity. You're seeing Democrats, some really calling for a hard line there, while Republicans see that as a non sequitur. There really isn't that much appetite at all among Republicans to move on gun control any more so than there has been in the past. And with the increasing effort, and certainly if there's a signal from former President Donald Trump that he doesn't see these policies, we've seen the way that Republicans have really ceded to his wishes on the Hill. So I don't see a lot of potential light there, perhaps a little more chance with gun control with folks like Tim Scott leading the negotiations there, somebody who is respected within the Republican conference. But if Donald Trump doesn't want it, it's very likely that Tim Scott will convince his colleagues otherwise.
You know, it seems like a kind of a tough situation there in Washington. A lot of a lot of blockage on almost every bill they're seeing, although I will say that President Biden did sign on to the new hate crimes legislation in response to attacks on Asian Americans. So that's a brighter light there. I'm going to give each of you a chance just to weigh in on what you think the tone and mood in Washington is right now. Scott?
Well, I think you're right. I think we are seeing, you know, moments of bipartisanship like the anti-Asian hate crimes bill this week. But by and large, you know, Republicans, their mentality heading into the 2022 election cycle is, you know, they are opposing the Biden agenda at every level. And they feel like that is going to be a winning strategy for them to retake the House and the Senate in the upcoming midterm elections.
Well, Kimberly, I said you'd both get a chance, and you can, but you got to be fast.
I agree with Scott. It's always good to agree with Scott.
Yeah, all right. Well, good. We'll leave it there. Kimberly Atkins, columnist for the Boston Globe, and Scott Wong, senior staff writer for The Hill. It's always great to speak with both of you. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Well, I'm sure you've heard by now the cicadas are coming by the billions. More than 15 states in the eastern U.S. are expecting to see these periodical cicadas known as Brood 10 in the coming weeks, as some are emerging already. As the ground gets warmer, these insects come out from underground every 17 years to find a mate. Scientists have been mapping cicadas for over a century, and now, thanks to an app, the public can help. Andy Cubis of Allegheny Front reports.
Look how many there are on the grass, Mom!
Catherine Riley and her 10-year-old daughter Madeline are on a safari, a cicada safari.
Can you believe that there used to be a city under us of them?
A cicada city under our feet? That's crazy!
The cicadas that are emerging now have been living underground for 17 years. In the last couple of weeks, they've started to appear in Georgia, North Carolina, Tennessee, and the Washington, D.C. area. Catherine and Madeline are in Crofton, Maryland.
Look how many are in the garden.
50.
At least.
Yeah.
The mother-daughter citizen scientist duo began taking pictures of the cicadas in their garden. Next, they'll upload them to a free app called Cicada Safari.
I mainly take some of the photos, but my mom does more of the getting in closer to the cicadas.
The photos Catherine and Madeline upload to the app are linked to their location via GPS, and the information is helping researchers track the emergence of Brood 10. Jean Kritsky is the dean of the School of Behavioral and Natural Sciences at Mount St. Joseph University in Cincinnati and the creator of Cicada Safari.
To really blow our minds, last night our 100,000th download occurred.
Kritsky says that they're adding about 3,000 new users a day. And lately, they've been averaging over 6,000 photographs a day.
Got 17 people helping me. Once verified, it goes on a live map. You can see your photograph, but you also see where they're coming out elsewhere.
Kritsky sees himself as part of a long lineage of scientists using the latest technology to track broods.
Back in the 1840s, a man by the name of Gideon B. Smith crowdsourced cicada records. And he did that by writing newspapers saying, "Dear sir, I expect this locust," which is what they call it those days, "to emerge in your part of the country. I would appreciate if your readers would send me word if they see them in their vicinity." So I feel like I'm the next step in the technology. And, you know, postcards were sent out in 1902. I did that, had an answering machine in 1987, emails in 2004. Now it's the phone app.
This year, Kritsky and his team added a new feature to the two-year-old app, video.
And so you hear a tree that's just screaming. And from the sound that comes with the video, we can identify the species.
This morning, I could actually hear them in my house. They're definitely letting their presence be known.
In North Georgia, where the first of the Brood 10 was spotted, Cicada Safari user Valerie Shadburn has recorded their distinctive singing in her woodsy backyard.
There was one that I thought was really neat coming out of the exoskeleton. I was like, oh, wow, this is super cool. So I've kind of just nerded out, I guess, but it's been fun. Yeah.
Shadburn is also ranked pretty high on the Cicada Safari's leaderboard, which logs how many photographs users have uploaded.
I'm in the top 10, last I looked.
Not bad out of more than 100,000 users.
You know, when I saw they were keeping score, I'm like, oh yeah, I could run with this.
Cicadas do not sting or bite, and they don't carry diseases. Pesticides don't work on them. And at any rate, Kritsky would like to remind everyone that they are not pests and do not need to be killed. So what good are they? He gets this question a lot.
Periodical cicadas do a lot of good for the eastern deciduous forest. For example, while they're underground for those 17 years, they turn over soil. When they emerge from the ground, they create these holes, and that's like a natural aeration of the soil. When the adults come out in big numbers, that's a food pulse. It's not something that the forest needs every year. This is once every 17 years. But every 17 years, that can have a benefit.
I would have never known what grass sounded like being moved by an army of cicadas unless I had gotten out there with this app.
Again, Catherine Riley.
We're not going to get an experience like this for another 17 years. I'd rather be out there and be a part of it and have those memories.
For Here and Now, I'm Andy Kubis.
And tune in next week when our producer Alexander Turk gets up close with cicadas in Maryland with entomologist and self-described bug guy Michael Raup.
In the meantime, let's put our ears on something else now. Pop star Demi Lovato has been open and vulnerable with fans when it comes to personal struggles with addiction and mental illness. And now Lovato is revealing even more.
I identify as non-binary. With that said, I'll officially be changing my pronouns to they, them. I feel that this best represents the fluidity I feel in my gender expression and allows me to feel most authentic and true to the person I both know I am and still am discovering.
Demi Lovato shared their pronouns this week on their new podcast, 4D. For more on Lovato's story, let's bring in Femi OK, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. She helps us analyze culture and conversations on social media. Femi, hi. Happy Friday.
Hello there. Happy Friday to you as well. Demi's announcement was so well crafted, so well produced. It's almost, Peter, almost like a campaign.
So what kind of reaction are you seeing?
So I just checked out to see how many people were looking up Demi Lovato this week. Google Trends tracks that over 1 million people who wouldn't normally be looking her up online, or looking up Demi Lovato, I should say, because she's using different pronouns right now, search for Demi Lovato. There's an appetite, there's interest. Demi trended on Twitter on Wednesday, and then across all of Demi's social media platforms, there are over 100 million followers. So many of them are now having conversations about gender and identity.
It is interesting when you think about how they came out as non-binary using a podcast. What do you make of that decision?
Using a new podcast. So this is a brand new podcast. It's a vehicle to deliver an intimate message. You can plan out exactly what you want to say. Episode one of the podcast starts with a mic drop moment. This is my new identity. This is the identity that I wasn't able to tell you about before. Guaranteed headlines. But what Demi does, Demi goes deeper and shares more. For instance, there's a moment where Demi makes a connection between overdosing on drugs in 2018 and not feeling able to be truly open. Have a listen.
I was suppressing who I really am in order to please stylists or team members or this or that, or even fans that wanted me to be the sexy feminine pop star in the leotard and look a certain way. You know, I thought that was what I was supposed to be.
And there are several moments, Peter, when Demi reminds the audience that May is Mental Health Month, and that on Twitter, Demi links to organizations like GLAAD and the Trevor Project, being very aware that fans may be having similar struggles.
You know, it's powerful to hear a celebrity say that they have the same sorts of struggles that everybody else does. Yeah. And Lovato is just the latest one to come out in this way. There's also the singer Sam Smith, Queer Eye's Jonathan Van Ness, Pose star India Moore. But, you know, Lovato didn't just drop the news and walk away. They also wanted to start a conversation with fans and try to answer questions that people might have about gender identity. How did they navigate that?
So Demi brings along a friend, Alok. So Alok is a writer and a performance artist, and together they're chatty, they're funny, they're honest, they tackle tricky questions people want to know when you announce that you're non-binary. Are you confused? Are you miserable? What do you choose to wear? Alok and Demi come prepared to take on the criticism, especially when it comes to changing the pronouns that you would like to be used about yourself and how upset people get when you start to do that. Here's Alok.
Then you hear the argument that they is not grammatically correct, so people refuse to use it. To which I ask, if you're more concerned about grammar than someone else's, like, life, identity, experience, like, this could go a long way in making someone's day just a little bit better. It's time that you get your priorities not straight, but queer, and realize that, like, actually caring for people and being a good human being is more important.
And there are a couple of stories this week following Demi's announcement of people making fun of neutral pronouns. And Demi says, this is my take. If you mess up, that's okay. Even I mess up. Just try.
Yeah, we all do. Why do you think this matters right now?
Well, there's still a lot of confusion about what non-binary means. And people online are getting upset about Demi saying, this is who I am now, and vehemently disagreeing with Demi for coming out. But there are two comments I wanted to leave you with. One is Yellen Y, and Yellen is on YouTube, having watched the podcast, the full podcast. This inspired me greatly, and I came out to my parents after watching this. Thank you so much, Demi, for giving me the courage to be myself. So much love. And then on Instagram, fans are direct messaging Demi. One fan says, I have a question. Can we still call you things like queen and girl as slang? A lot of your Lovatics, they are Demi Lovato fans, aren't sure, and they just want to make sure you feel comfortable. I've got so many more questions. Demi goes right into the direct messages. You're so sweet. I'm not sure what the correct term is. Honestly, Demi is good enough for me. And then the fan says, oh, that's so perfect. And then Demi says, and y'all can just call me daddy, fan. Okay, Daddy Demi. And that just gives you an idea of how Demi Lovato, however you want to describe her, is connecting with her fans during this very important, intimate moment for herself that she shared with the world.
It's an example of what happens when you are out there talking about stuff. Others open absolutely. Up with you. Let's listen. Let's listen to some Demi Lovato music. What do you think?
I think it's about time.
Enough. That is I Love Me by Demi Lovato. It feels appropriate today. Femi, okay, you are a 10 out of 10, and don't you ever forget it.
Thank you, Peter. Take care, everybody.
Imagine a TV show with no plot, no characters, no tension.
So we're seeing the train leave what is presumably a stop.
Yeah, and it's like we're looking out the window at the very front.
And yet, it was a huge hit.
Very unexpected success, yes.
We've got a story that questions storytelling as we know it on NPR's Invisibilia podcast.
Today, Apple CEO Tim Cook is on the defensive in a courtroom in Oakland in a case that could break Apple's tight grip on its App Store. At the heart of Epic Games' lawsuit against the iPhone maker is the fact that Apple only allows its own App Store on its devices and takes a 30% cut of most purchases made through those apps. Epic says that exclusivity constitutes a monopoly. For more, let's bring in Mike Regan. He's senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So all this started over Epic's insanely popular shooter game, Fortnite. A quick recap for listeners. Epic didn't want to pay the 30% cut we mentioned, so they broke Apple's rules and gave users a way to pay Epic directly for in-game purchases, and Apple pulled the game off the App Store. Epic immediately filed a lawsuit, and a lot of experts called it a trap by Epic to force this antitrust issue right now that's in the courts. So remind us again, Mike, what's at stake here for these two titanic companies?
A huge part of Tim Cook's strategy has been for Apple to make more money from services like the App Store, for example, instead of just selling phones and computers. So a ruling in Epic's favor would really shake up that strategy pretty dramatically. And on the other side, it would have just a major impact, not just on Epic, but there are literally huge numbers. I've seen numbers in the millions of developers out there who make apps for phones. So it is a potentially a very, very sort of watershed moment for that whole industry, Jane, of developing apps for mobile phones.
And how's it been going today in court? What has Tim Cook been saying?
So a lot of the questions he's getting involve, why is Apple's own App Store the only one available on iPhones? And in a nutshell, he's responding that it's because the company believes that's the best way to protect its users, to protect their privacy and their data, and to keep malicious software off their phones. And Tim Cook says he really wouldn't trust a third party to review those apps. He also, you know, claims Apple does have competition in the app stores. If you have another type of phone, there's the Google Play app, the Samsung app. He even points at video game console makers like Xbox and PlayStation as what he considers competitors. So he's trying to push back on that notion that Apple has a monopoly when it comes to selling apps.
Hmm. Well, this trial is expected to wrap up next week. But even if it goes Apple's way, do you think this trial has drawn attention to Apple's practices with its App Store? And what could that mean for other legal fights for Apple?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Shane. I think, you know, all of Silicon Valley and really the software world across the globe is watching this very closely. And I think there's a chance that the Justice Department, depending on the ruling, might want to take a look at what Apple's doing as well from a sort of a broader perspective.
Well, we will watch. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jane.
Songstress Eartha Kitt enthralled audiences beginning in the 1940s, up until just months before her death in 2008. Her best-known song is probably this sultry Christmas classic from 1953.
Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight.
But Eartha Kitt was much more than her sex kitten image. She supported Martin Luther King and was an advocate for women's rights in the LGBTQ community. And though the world viewed her as black, she refused to be defined by her color. Eartha's daughter, Kit Shapiro, was her mother's closest confidant. Kit tells the story of their relationship in the new book, Eartha and Kit. She joins me now. And Kit Shapiro, I had the good fortune of seeing your mother give a magnetic performance of that song. It was more than 20 years ago. Talk about the stage persona that she created.
Well, she never really thought of herself as a sex symbol. I think she found that to be somewhat comical in some ways. But I do think she cultivated the image of Eartha Kitt. She really, I think, wanted to have a persona that kept her safe and gave her some strength. And I think over time, this persona of this incredibly strong and self-controlled woman came to be from, you know, a combination of different things from her life. Mm.
Your mother, Eartha Kitt, was nominated for 3 Tony Awards, 3 Emmys, 2 Grammys. She made dozens of movies, starred in numerous Broadway shows. I'm curious, aside from the talent, what was it about that discipline that made her such a great performer?
I think one of the things that made her a great performer was her ability to be vulnerable and to show who she really was on that stage, even though it was, you know, covered in this persona of being the sex kitten. When she would sing, you really saw her emotion and you really felt the words that she was singing.
If you go away on the summer day, then you might as well take the sun away. And the birds that flew in the summer sky, when our love was new and our hearts were high, and the days were long and the nights were young, and the moon stood still for the night birds' song. If you go away, if you go away, if you go away.
What's so remarkable about her life, she came from extreme poverty. She had a very difficult upbringing. You write in the book that Eartha's mother, part Native American, part African American, she was 16 when she had Eartha and then abandoned her. Eartha Kitt never knew her father. Can you talk a little bit about her childhood and how it shaped her?
My mother was called a yellow gal, and in the part of South Carolina that she was born in. She was too light-skinned for, you know, everybody else, and it was presumed that her biological father was probably a white man. But I think she struggled her entire life with the fact that her mother gave her up because her mother married a man, a black man, who said, "I will not have that yellow gal living in my house." And my mother was given to a family who treated her horribly. The mother, as well as the teenage children, physically abused, sexually abused, emotionally abused her. You know, these were scars she carried her entire life, yet she didn't hide them. She was always willing to talk about it. She didn't want to forget those tough times because they kept her very honest and very real.
Well, and I think in many ways it seems like that's why she fought so tirelessly for others, because of the experience of her early life.
No question about that. My mother really wanted to be able to give voice to anybody who needed their voices heard.
You tell some wonderful stories in the book. I love the story of Eartha Kitt traveling on tour with 10 tuxedos of various sizes. And before each performance, Eartha's manager would check to make sure the audience was integrated. And if there weren't enough black faces in the crowd, you write that Eartha would dress the kitchen staff in those tuxedos, bring them into the audience, and seat them right there on the front row. She was relentless in her effort to bring social and cultural change.
No question. She didn't understand our society's need to treat each other differently because of the color of one's skin. And she didn't understand injustices for other people's religious beliefs or social beliefs. And she felt that we were all entitled to live side by side. And so when she could make impact, you know, my mother would explain to me that it doesn't take, you don't have to have the biggest soapbox. You don't have to have the loudest voice. Everybody can affect change.
Your mother accepted an invitation to perform in South Africa during apartheid, and she certainly made a statement there, again stipulating that she would only perform for integrated audiences, which was really unheard of at the time there. Tell me about that trip.
There's so many ironies in that trip for me personally, because obviously by the time I was born, my mother was already a famous person. So I didn't witness my mother being treated differently. I witnessed my mother being treated as a celebrity. That's how, you know, I grew up. When we went to South Africa, was the first time I had experienced my mother being treated differently because of the color of her skin. I didn't see any differences between the two of us, even though our skin color is very different. I am very light-skinned with blonde hair and light eyes, and my mother is clearly a woman of color. But there were times in South Africa where people didn't necessarily know who she was. And there was one specific instance in an amusement park where I had been allowed in because nobody questioned my race, given how I look. And my mother came with me one day, and she was told that she needed to leave because it was a whites-only park. She got up very quietly and took my hand, and we went to leave. And it turned out that later in that week, she had an opportunity to do a photo shoot with the amusement park in the background. And my mother made a comment, you know, to the press. Oh, it's very funny. I was thrown out of that park earlier this week. The press put it in the headlines, the newspaper, or the kid thrown out of the amusement park. And the owner of the amusement park came and said, you know, I'm so sorry. I apologize. And is there anything I can do to make it up to you? She said, well, I would love a donation. We're raising funds to build schools for African children. And my daughter would really like to come back to the amusement park with her friends. And so he gave us some tickets. And when we went back to the amusement park, my mother brought an array of children, you know, in all different races. So to her, that was more impactful, that photograph that there is, and it's in the book. That image was much more impactful than had she stood up and made a scene when she was asked to leave. She understood that, you know, we have power, and sometimes you have to wait till the moment is right.
Eartha Kitt might be most recognizable to a certain generation because she starred as Catwoman in the 60s television series Batman, and we have a scene from that. Let's listen.
How can Batgirl be the best anything when Catwoman is around? No best-dressed list is complete without the addition of the Queen of Criminals, the Princess of Plunder, yours untruly.
Such a recognizable tone, the way she spoke. You say, you write that people would recognize her on the street and ask her to purr for them as Catwoman. Is that true? Yes. Did she do it?
Yes. She would do it because she understood that, you know, fans are who were, you know, made her who she was. And she loved the character of Catwoman. She found her to be just so over the top. What I find so interesting is, as an adult, I look back on Catwoman now and I think about what an incredible trailblazer that character was. Here was a woman of color who was opposite the white male lead, and there was this sexual tension, this flirtatiousness between the two of them. You know, in 1967, 1968, that was really, you know, unheard of.
It's been over 12 years since your mother died in 2008. I'm curious, has writing this book helped bring her back to you in some way? And what do you most clearly remember about her now?
It's interesting to look back on. I really feel her impact is more relevant than ever. She not only understood the importance of treating human beings with care, but she understood the importance of treating our planet and our environment with care. And, you know, I mean, I felt that my mother was always with me, you know, as hard as it is to lose a mother, especially as an only child. But I feel like even more now that she's looking down and saying, okay, this is good. This is what you know, let your voice be heard. Let my voice continue to be heard.
Kit Shapiro's book is Eartha and Kit, A Daughter's Love Story in Black and White. Kit Shapiro, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
We know quite well at this point in the pandemic that Hispanic communities have been hit hard by the virus. But Hispanic people have also been less likely than white people to get the COVID-19 vaccine. It's not because they don't want it. They just face more barriers to get it. A new report by the Kaiser Family Foundation sheds light on this. And Kaiser's Liz Hamel joins us now. Liz, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And when you look at this most recent data, what kind of discrepancies are you seeing in vaccination rates between different groups of people?
Sure. Well, we've seen over time that Black and Hispanic adults have lagged behind their white counterparts in terms of the share of people who are getting a vaccine. And what we've actually found in our most recent survey is that among unvaccinated Hispanic adults, there's a larger share that's actually really wants to get the vaccine right away. About a third of unvaccinated Hispanic adults say they'd like to get the vaccine as soon as possible, and that's higher than it is for other groups.
Oh, that's interesting, because it feels, I think, for many people, for some people, that supply is no longer an issue, that we've gotten to a point in this pandemic where if you want to get vaccinated, you can. But you're saying that's not entirely true. Why?
Yeah, I think that what we're seeing is that access means more than just saying that anybody can go and get the vaccine. We find that for people who haven't gotten the vaccine, and particularly for Hispanic adults, that they're concerned about things like not being able to miss work if they experience side effects from the vaccine, or not being able to get the vaccine from a place that they trust, or having difficulty traveling to a vaccination site. So although I think you're right that we're seeing in most places that supply of the vaccine is exceeding demand at this point, there are still barriers for people when it comes to actually going and getting the shot.
And we should be clear, what you're talking about here is different than hesitancy or reluctance.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are still some issues in terms of people's trust in the vaccine. People are concerned about safety and side effects, and that type of thing still needs to be addressed. But in addition, we find that there are just logistical barriers and things that could be addressed by strategies to make it easier for people to actually access the vaccine.
Well, let's talk about a few of the other barriers that you have been looking into. One of them is cost. But actually, that shouldn't be a barrier because the vaccine is free. But not everyone knows that.
Yes, and this is where we find significant information gaps. We find that a number of people, and in fact, about half of Hispanic adults who haven't been vaccinated yet, say they're concerned that they might have to pay an out-of-pocket cost to get the vaccine. So there's a need to get that information out there and make sure that everybody knows that the vaccine won't come at any cost to you.
You also hinted at this, but many people in this group are working. They're caring for families. They don't have the time to go get vaccinated. What should we do about that?
Well, I think, again, this is where different actors could come and make the vaccine more accessible to people. So we found that a lot of people said, you know, if their employer brought the vaccine to their workplace, they'd be more likely to get it. Or if it was offered to them at a place they normally go for healthcare, they would be more likely to get it. So there are things that can be done to address those concerns, particularly, as you said, for people who are busy with jobs and families and for whom going to get the vaccine may not be as easy as it is for some other people.
And what did you learn for people whose immigration status might be an issue?
We found that for Hispanic adults overall, about 4 in 10 of those who aren't vaccinated were concerned about having to provide some kind of documentation. And about a third were concerned that if they went to get the vaccine, they could potentially cause a negative impact on either their own or a family member's immigration status. And when we look at people in the survey who could potentially be undocumented, people who tell us that they were born outside the U.S. and have not received legal documentation, about 2/3 in that group is really worried about getting the vaccine from a trusted place and worried about not having an impact on the immigration status of themselves or someone in their family.
So your data is important, but so is the context here. The new guidelines from the CDC came out saying that fully vaccinated people, for the most part, no longer need to wear masks in public, which might be okay for communities where there is a high rate of vaccination, but could still leave people who want to get vaccinated at risk if they're having trouble getting access to the shot. Do you think the CDC missed the mark on that?
Well, I think, you know, what we know is that people who have not been able to get vaccinated yet are essential workers. They're working with the public and they may be working hourly jobs. And that's one of the reasons they haven't been able to take time off to get the vaccine. And so I do think those people, you know, if they work in places where other people are unmasked, could potentially be at risk.
Liz Hamel is Vice President and Director of Public Opinion and Survey Research at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. Have a great weekend. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Jane Clayson in Boston. It's Here and Now.